All right, guys, you are Locked On Falcons. I'm your host, Aaron Freeman, and today is an all 22 review where I'll be giving you my thoughts on what the film said from the Falcons week 7 loss to the Detroit Lions, as well as answering your Atlanta Falcons listener question.
You are Locked On Falcons, your daily Atlanta Falcons podcast, part of the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.
So today's Locked On Falcons podcast is presented by Pepsi, made for football watching. Thanks to a lack of natural athleticism or commitment or overbearing sports parents, fewer than 1% of 1% of 1% of people will ever play professional football. But instead of entering the NFL, they've joined another league, the League of Football Watchers. This football season will be different, and Pepsi is here to get you ready for game day no matter how you watch. I'm watching at home from the comfort of my couch on a 40-inch screen this year, and Pepsi is the refreshment that you need to power through any game day, because Pepsi isn't made for those who play the game. It's made for those who watch it. Pepsi, made for football watching. Go to madeforfootballwatching.com to check out the latest football watching content from Pepsi. So, guys, you know me. I'm Aaron Freeman. Been covering the Falcons for many years, formerly on FalcFans.com, RIP, currently still going strong on Twitter at FalcFans, and, of course, hosting this world-renowned Locked On Falcons podcast, your daily Atlanta Falcons podcast, right here on the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day. And today's episode is an all-22 review. I'll sort of talk about the Falcons coverage breakdowns and what sort of my observations from that final drive against the Detroit Lions in terms of they drew up something, it didn't work, and we'll get into why it didn't work coming up on today's podcast. But we also have a bunch of listener questions and a few that scratched the surface. We're going to talk about Matt Ryan's audibling, whether the Falcons are starting to shadow more receivers by flipping AJ Terrell and Kendall Sheffield, whether we're going to revisit some past draft takes and draft picks, maybe what I would have done had I been in control of the Falcons front office. We'll talk about some potential coaching candidates and whether a current assistant in Tampa Bay is on the Falcons radar, maybe not the guy that you're thinking of. And we'll sort of talk about a new and changing power structure within the Falcons front office and the dynamic between the coach and the general manager that may have played a role in the Falcons' past coaching decisions, as well as may play a role in their future coaching decisions. So without further ado, let's sort of jump into that Locked On Falcons lead story, talking about the coverage breakdowns that led to the late game letdown in week 7 against the Lions. So when charting the Falcons coverages, they were able to pretty much get pressure on that final drive. The problem was that pressure wasn't enough to bring down Lions quarterback Matt Stafford, as he was able to make some off-platform and off-balance throws into some wide-open windows. Really, that signaled the breakdown was on the back end for the Falcons, and the Falcons decided to play cover two zone for the bulk of that drive, and that proved problematic. Why did the Falcons decide to play zone, you ask? Well, probably because up to that point in the game, it was their most effective coverage. They had deployed cover two 5 times prior to that final drive, and the Lions had managed to produce a success rate of 40% on those 5 plays. Comparatively, prior to that last possession, the Falcons had utilized man coverage or cover one 15 times, and the Lions fared slightly better against it with a 47% success rate. Their cover three zone was utilized 8 times prior to that final possession, and the Lions' success rate was 50%. Notably, the Falcons opted to play cover one and cover three during the closing seconds in the final drive in the first half, when they allowed the Lions to drive 40 plus yards in 3 plays to get into field goal range in just under 29 seconds. So technically, the Falcons' best coverage show, also factoring in the Falcons' decision to play cover two at the end of the game, was that technically coverage two is their best coverage cell that they've used so far this season. The Falcons have run cover two on a roughly 25% of their pass plays and given up a passer rating of 89 on those plays. That compares to their cover three, which they've used slightly more on 26% of their plays and have given up a passer rating of 109. And then the cover one, which has been their most popular coverage, on 48% of their plays, and they've allowed a passer rating of 123. And it was primarily that man coverage that they deployed in their past late game meltdowns against the Dallas Cowboys and Chicago Bears in weeks 2 and 3, respectively. Also, in theory, the cover two does offer a bit of balance in being pretty decent at protecting against the deep ball by having multiple deep defenders, particularly in comparison to, say, cover one, and also having enough bodies underneath to sort of rally to the ball in case the Lions are trying to dink and dunk their way down the field in that final drive, as opposed to the cover three. So there were certainly reasons for the Falcons to trust in their cover two, but ultimately it failed them. And it's just further proof that there's no sort of magic coverage shell that's going to solve this defense or really any defense's problems. Notably, the Falcons, once they got onto that last play on the final play of the game, they deployed cover three on that play. And it was linebacker Foye Olukun who vacated his zone, allowing Lions tight end TJ Hockenson to settle into it for the game winning touchdown. And it's simple. Players didn't execute. And while a defensive tackle like Grady Jarrett, among others, was able to help move Matt Stafford off his spot on multiple plays on that end drive, it wasn't enough of a disruption to really stop the Lions from doing the thing that two other teams have done also against the Falcons defense this year, which is guide their teams down the field in the closing minutes to get a game-winning score. So this interim coaching staff can certainly continue to try and tweak the scheme all they want, but if they can't find ways to get players to better execute whatever they're calling, they're essentially going to be throwing stuff at a wall and hoping something is going to stick. And it's unlikely it's going to stick any better moving forward because the Falcons' schedule is only going to get harder, particularly in the back half of the season, where six of their final seven games are coming against opponents that are currently 500 or better and also rank in the top 10 offenses according to Football Outsiders DVOA rankings. So it's really probably only going to get worse as better offenses are going to be able to find easier ways to exploit the cracks that are frequent in this Falcons defense. So, guys, there's your Locked On Falcons lead story, and we are going to continue today's podcast by getting into the Q&A portion of today, and we are going to get into the notion of whether or not the Falcons deserve credit for not passing on Todd Gurley for a second time, whether or not the Falcons should be, or at least we should be, more critical of Matt Ryan's inability or unwillingness to audible at the line of scrimmage. And we'll also get into whether or not the Falcons are utilizing more shadow coverage on their defense coming up on today's podcast. But before we get there, I want to let you guys know that we know that the Falcons have all the wrong parts on their defense. And if only there was a website where they could go and find the best parts for reliably low prices, given their current cap situation. And if there is, you know, I don't know what that website is, but I do know where you can go if you're looking for the best parts for reliably low prices for your car or truck. And that's, of course, rockauto.com. They have everything from engine control modules, brake parts, tail lamps, motor oil, even new floor mats. Get everything you need in just a few easy clicks delivered directly to your door. And the rockauto.com catalog is unique. It's easy to navigate. You can quickly see all the parts available for your car or truck and choose by brand, specification, and the prices that you prefer. And the prices at rockauto.com are always reliably low. The same for professionals and do-it-yourselfers. Why spend up to twice as much for the same parts? Go to rockauto.com right now. See all the parts available for your vehicle. Write "Locked On" in the "How did you hear about us" box so that they know we sent you. Amazing selection, reliably low prices, all the parts your car will ever need. rockauto.com. So our first question comes from Stephen Bounds on Twitter. He asks, do the Falcons deserve more credit for not being dumb enough to pass on Gurley a second time? I guess, I think a lot of it was Gurley really wanted to play in Atlanta. And, you know, the Falcons had a pretty big void at the running back position with the release of Devontae Freeman. So I don't know if we should go overboard championing that move, but it was a legitimately good move, you know, especially getting Gurley at the price tag that they were able to get him. But when you factor in that, you know, they paid Dante Fowler three times as much and he's been as ineffective as he's been, I'm not going to go out of my way to heap tons and tons of praise on the Falcons for the Gurley move when they've made it arguably a much worse move in contrast to that. So, as they always say about this podcast and me, you know, always focusing on the negative, but yeah, it was a good move, but you know, let's not go overboard with the praise. Jamel at JKane86 on Twitter asked, do you think that a franchise quarterback should take some blame for bad play calling since they should have a few audible plays to pick from? Just curious. I don't have a problem with Matt Ryan, but I'm just trying to find some clarity. Not really. you know, I think a lot of NFL teams, you know, quarterbacks do have the flexibility to audible, but probably not as much as people think. It's not as if like you can just simply go out there and be like, well, they called, you know, play X. Well, you know what? I'm audibling play Y because that play is not going to work. That you can't have that sort of combative relationship between the quarterback and the offensive coordinator. You want to have a situation where quarterback has some flexibility, particularly like in certain situations where, you know, they're going to try to run the ball on third and one, and they stack the box, and then the quarterback will have the flexibility. You know, they run a situation where the defense has nine players in the box. They only have eight people to block it on a third and one or whatever, and the quarterback has the flexibility to audible out of that. Like, those are the things you want to do. So I don't think it's fair to criticize someone like a Matt Ryan for not audibling out of bad play calls, because at the end of the day, it's the players' jobs to execute the things that the coaches are being called. And this is not a Peyton Manning situation where he's essentially his own offensive coordinator here in Atlanta, and nor really should it be. Our next question comes from Riley S. via email. He asks, I think I've been seeing AJ Terrell play both sides of the field. This hasn't been how we've approached our cornerbacks in the past. Is this true, or am I just not paying enough attention? And if that's what's happening, are we following someone, or does it have to do with which of the other corners we're bringing in and out of which package we're playing? No, your eyes are not deceiving you, Riley. In weeks 5 and 6, especially once AJ Terrell came back, the Falcons played a lot more shadow man coverage. They also did this as well in week 4 with, against Green Bay when Terrell was out of the lineup as well. In that game, they put, Sheffield on Marquez Valdes-Scantling, who was at that point, given the Packers injuries, their number one wide receiver. And you saw this in week 5 where you saw a lot of matchups between Sheffield and Robbie Anderson, and AJ Terrell was mostly on DJ Moore in a lot of their man coverage assignments. They kind of switched that out at the end of the game, and that's why you got DJ Moore against Isaiah Oliver, you know, on that touchdown. In week 6, you saw it was mostly Sheffield on Justin Jefferson, and it was AJ Terrell on Adam Thielen. So you saw that quite a bit the last couple of games. Not so much this past week against Detroit. There was a little bit, you know, I think 7 of AJ Terrell snaps when he lined up wide were not at the left cornerback position, but for the most part, they parked him on the left side of the defense, and he went toe to toe with whoever was on that side of the field. And for the most part, played pretty well, and certainly has been proving himself to be, I think, the Falcons' top corner far and away. You know, I think Sheffield has done some positive things, but Sheffield's technique is just awful. He's just playing out of control. You know, Isaiah Oliver has, as I've infamously said on this podcast in the past, I think Oliver has made strides. He's not good, but I think he's probably not as terrible as he's often billed to be, as if he's like the worst corner in the history of the world. I think he's done a fine job, but in the last couple of games, they've kind of been able to hide him as a slot corner, which I've been surprised at how effective it's been. You know, there were a couple of plays in the Detroit game where I felt like he could have gotten exposed there more so than he has in recent weeks. So, you know, maybe that was just a particular matchup, or, you know, maybe that's something that the Falcons can do moving forward, but we'll have to sort of see. But I think clearly AJ Terrell is far and away the team's best corner, and the other two guys right now, Sheffield and Oliver, both whom are under contract for another year here in Atlanta, I think should be probably backups. And when Darquez Dennard comes back, hopefully next week against Denver, doesn't sound like he's coming back this week for the Carolina game, or, you know, unless I miss some news today. When he comes back, he'll probably be the starter. And then the question is going to be, what do the Falcons do at the nickel? Do they move Sheffield to the nickel? Do they keep Oliver there? I'm assuming they'll keep Sheffield there. Or do they decide to, let's put Dennard in the middle, and we'll continue to play Sheffield on the outside in those nickel situations? So that'll be an interesting conversation. And we'll see if the Falcons continue to play some shadow coverage. I think it would make sense. I think, you know, putting AJ Terrell on the opposing team's top wide receiver, I think, would have made a lot of sense. I think you can certainly make a strong argument that if they had done that against Kenny Golladay and shadowed him, maybe Terrell would have done a much better job preventing some of those catches that Golladay had at the end of the first half that set up the field goal then, and also the big catch at the end of the game. But again, going back to what we talked about earlier, they playing cover two, but that's only in man coverage, which they didn't really do outside of the first play, which was an incomplete pass where Stafford threw the ball to Golladay out of bounds. But yeah, I'm rambling now, And we're going to continue today's Q&A episode, getting into some listener questions about, you know, revisiting some old draft takes, as well as talking about some coaching candidates and sort of the past and current and future dynamic between the coach and the GM and who has personnel power. And so those will be the topics that we will wrap up today's Q&A episode for. And because it's a Q&A episode, I should go ahead and plug the fact that if you are listening to today's episode and wondering, hey, I got questions about the Falcons, or I got questions about really about anything, you know, at this point in time in the season, you guys can ask me questions about whatever, and I'll happily talk about any subject that's not related to the Falcons on the podcast. But you can send in your questions to me about whatever you want to talk about, or provide your feedback to me, things that you like about the show, things that you don't like about the show. I'm open for all the feedback that you want to provide, and you can send those questions or feedback to me on Twitter via Locked On Falcons, via Facebook at Locked On Falcons, or you can send an email to LockedOnFalcons@mail.com. So we can only control so much in this world, whether the Falcons defense gets a stop or Dirk Koetter will stop running the ball on second and long. Again, we can only control so much. But one thing we can control is what we put into our bodies. And let's put something there that is healthy, but also tastes great. And the good folks at Built Bar are helping us out with that. Built Bars are low in calories and sugar, high in protein, high in fiber, perfect for keto diets. Anybody's health conscious that wants to get a great tasting protein bar. Built Bar has 6 new flavors that they launched this summer. I've always been a fan of the coconut, almond, and peanut butter flavors, but I can now add caramel brownie, cookies and cream, cherry barcia, lemon almond cheesecake, carrot cake, apple almond crisp to my rotation. And for a limited time, you can also add Built Bites, the same great tasting Built Bars in a smaller size. And they also have the strawberry flavor in stock. And trust me, guys, you want to take advantage of that opportunity for this limited time purchase. All you have to do is head over to builtbar.com, use the promo code Locked On, and you'll get 20% off your next order. Don't worry, if you've already used that promo code once, you can use it again. Again, use the promo code Locked On for 20% off at builtbar.com. Greg E. asks, you've opined many times about the draft picks we've made over the years, going back as far as 2017. What players would you have drafted instead that were still available at the time, and how have those players performed with the teams that did select them? Well, Greg, you're going to consider this a bit of a cop-out, but I don't really have those opinions. And the amount of research I would have to do in order to try to manufacture those opinions is just too much for me. You know, and that comes from way, way back in the day, formerly at FileFans.com, RIP. I used to, you know, from like 2001 through 2011, or really 2012, pretty much every year, I would write up like anywhere between 120 to 150, 180, 200 plus scouting reports pre-draft on FileFans.com. And then that sort of culminated in 2011 when I did over 300, I think 311 is the exact number, 312, somewhere around there. And then the Falcons, of course, traded up for Julio Jones, took like 5 of the guys I wrote up. And basically I came to the realization that I did all that work, all those hours throughout the fall and spring to be able to write up that many scouting reports of watching 3, 4, 5 games of, you know, 300 plus players was all for naught. And so really over the last 5 to 7 years, I've mostly taking a wait and see approach when it comes to evaluating players until after the draft. And yes, I will certainly watch guys pre-draft to establish a baseline. There are certainly players that I like pre-draft, see Miles Jack, but that was also kind of a seminal moment for me back in that 2016 draft, because I got all jacked up for Jack and the Falcons disappointed me. And I decided after that point, starting in 2017, to not try to get as overly attached to, you know, the prospect of my dream, because it was just setting myself up for disappointment. So generally I don't have strong takes about what the Falcons should do pre-draft. Instead, I wait till after the draft and have strong takes about what they actually did do in the draft by watching 4 to 8 games of each draft pick. But certainly I did have players I liked in some past drafts in 2017. I certainly, you know, was in favor of the Falcons going edge and in offensive guard in the first 2 rounds. And whether that was a combination of Forrest Lamp and Derek Rivers or whoever else. And both of those guys haven't, you know, to answer your question, neither one of those guys has had a lot of success, in large part due to injuries in their respective places in LA and with the Chargers and New England. I remember in 2018, you know, being a big fan of Traquan Smith and Michael Gallup and hoping that the Falcons would wait until round three or four to take one of those guys as the wide receiver. If you had asked me sort of who I probably would have wanted in round one, I probably would have been a Taven Bryan guy. And I know he's had an up and down tenure in Jacksonville. I know Pro Football Focus has not been kind to grading him this year. I know he showed some promise last year. If you'd asked me sort of who I would have taken in round two, if I was waiting for a wide receiver in round three, probably would have been a guard, but I know some of the guards that I liked, like Austin Corbett, had been taken by the time the Falcons were on the board. So, you know, I tried not to make too much of my pre-draft process is less about who I like and more about trying to find the guys that I think the Falcons are going to like. And so I don't really look back on drafts with sort of hindsight, and I don't find that particularly valuable. I think what if scenarios are certainly fun. You know, what if we had traded for Drew Brees in 2004? What if we had not traded up for Julio Jones in 2011? And maybe there's an alternate universe where we didn't make that trade. And in round one, we took Gabe Kareemi that year. In round two, we took Kelechi Osemele and David DeCastro with our top two picks the following year, instead of Peter Kontz and Lamar Holmes. And maybe the Falcons in that alternate reality are much more known over the last decade for having a great offensive line, similar to, say, like the Dallas Cowboys, and having crappy wide receivers because, you know, they wound up settling for Denarius Moore. And, like, we just kept drafting crappy wide receivers, or Jonathan Baldwin. And we would have spent the last decade, instead of Falcon fans being known for complaining about all the non-trench player, you know, all the trench players that we didn't draft, we'd be complaining about, man, why can't we draft any good skill position players to help Matt Ryan become a better quarterback and all that sort of thing? That's a fun scenario, right? It's an interesting scenario to talk about. But at no point do I ever go back and revisit that and say, like, that's what we should have done, you know? Similarly, I try to focus more on the present and the future of the team. And, you know, when I look back at the past, I try to look back at it from the lens of, okay, the causality lens of how did we get to where we are right now, right? Not as this is what we should have done to avoid our current present or whatever. I just think that's just using hindsight. And I just think, you know, hindsight is not valuable because it's clarity that you're never going to have when it comes to making better future and present decisions, you know, cause you're never going to have the clarity that comes from hindsight. So, sorry for the cop-out answer, Greg, but I don't have strong takes about past picks. Basically the story is if I had been based off of my opinions of players at that time, again, based off of a very small sample size of like one or two games, I would have been drafting busts all over the place. But had I been in those shoes, you know, I would have done a lot more homework. But because I didn't do homework, I don't really have those opinions or strong opinions in that regard. So our next question comes from Diedrich L. He asks, hey, Aaron, can you speak on if the Falcons have any interest in Byron Leftwich as our next offensive coordinator? You know, I think Leftwich could get some looks, but I think at this point in time, he's probably not going to be one of the more sought after people. I think a lot of it for him is going to be in Tampa Bay. He's going to be overshadowed. Whatever he does is going to be overshadowed by Bruce Arians and Tom Brady's presence is there. I think it'll be similar for people to dismiss him and sort of the agency that he has and whatever agency he has in Tampa Bay's offensive success. Similar to, I think this was played against Eric Bieniemy last year and why he got passed over in the coaching cycle, in addition to other variables that may or may not play for or against Byron Leftwich. But a lot of people looked at Kansas City's success and say, oh, that's Andy Reid, that's Patrick Mahomes. Eric Bieniemy doesn't really have anything to do with that. You know, let's hire Zach Taylor or Joe Judge or whoever, right? So, you know, when I look at this upcoming cycle, my expectation is that the top offensive-minded candidates that are going to be the in vogue thing to hire are going to be in no particular order. Bieniemy, Joe Brady from Carolina, Arthur Smith from Tennessee, Brian Daboll from Buffalo, Josh McDaniels from New England, Greg Roman from Baltimore, Kellen Moore from Dallas, although that could change if Dallas offense continues to struggle. I think you'll probably see those guys be prioritized over Leftwich, unless Leftwich can go and blow away people in the interviews. And I don't know if he's going to get that many interviews, because I imagine if anybody's, you know, knocking down Tampa Bay's door to interview somebody, you know, Todd Bowles is probably going to get a lot more looks than Leftwich will, among their assistants. And of course, you know, Bowles is going to be in the mix with other defensive minded candidates like Don Martindale from Baltimore, Matt Eberflus from Indianapolis, Keith Butler from Pittsburgh, Robert Saleh from San Francisco. And that doesn't include coaches like Urban Meyer, Lincoln Riley, Jim Harbaugh from the college ranks. Obviously, I'm not sure that the Falcons will look at one of those college candidates because they've already been burned by Bobby Petrino. But I imagine the moderate success that we've seen so far from Cliff Kingsbury and Matt Rhule so far in their short NFL tenures means that other NFL teams will be a lot less fearful. So, you know, if I was to sit here and say, like, you know, I don't have any inside information about Byron Leftwich, but I would imagine, based off of what I've just said, like, you know, Leftwich is not going to really be in anybody's top 10, at least right now. But, you know, by the time we get to January, if Tampa Bay winds up being the sort of front runner to be the Super Bowl team, you know, people's attitudes towards him may wind up changing and he may become a lot more in vogue by the time we get to January, February, when the coaching cycle begins, than he seems to be right now. But I would imagine right now he's probably on the outside looking in. And I would assume Atlanta is a similar boat as that goes. All right, Frank E., this question came a couple of weeks ago, and I unfortunately overlooked it. Sorry, Frank. But he has three questions, and he has a little bit of a spiel. He said, I heard Rich McKay talk about the head coach and GM hiring process the other day. He and Arthur Blank both deferred personnel questions to the new head coach and general manager, but McKay described the new GM as having roster control, if I heard correctly. He also said something to the effect of, that's what we were actually trying to do with Dan Quinn and Dimitroff at the end of the 19 when I came back into football operations. I know that Quinn had final roster approval as part of the decision to retain Dimitroff in 2015. My questions are, one, do you think part of retaining Quinn last year was moving that roster control slash approval back under football operations? My answer to that, Frank, is maybe. I don't really have a strong opinion on that. Frank's next question is, two, how do you think it will affect this search for the new general manager if McKay said the new GM will have roster control instead of the head coach? You know, I'm not sure it will. I imagine that's what the Falcons' plans are right now, in terms of how they want it structured, but they might fall in love with a certain coaching candidate that does want personnel control, and they might be willing to give it to him. You know, that's probably more likely to be a big name coach or a retread. So, like, you know, I don't think the Falcons are going to be able to get someone like Urban Meyer, or Lincoln Riley, or Jim Harbaugh without giving them considerable personnel control or the ability to potentially handpick their general manager. So that may not mean that the Falcons may be less likely to hire one of those guys if they're so inclined. So, you know, maybe that means that the Falcons will be more likely to hire a first-time head coach again, which they have done every time with the exception of Petrino under Arthur Blank. So we'll see. But maybe Arthur Blank decides to switch that up this time because he's done that three times and it hasn't worked out. So we'll see. So to answer your question, I think, like, that's the plan now. But who knows, by the time we get to January, they might be like, we really want Urban Meyer here. He's going to change the culture, blah, 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 blah. And he wants personnel control and we're willing to give it to him. Frank's third question is, do you think, in retrospect, that giving a first-time head coach final roster approval was a bad idea? It seemed to work out the first couple of years, but maybe Quinn, being such a player's coach, worked against him when it came to difficult roster decisions. No, I don't think it was a bad idea. You know, I think at that point in time, Dimitroff kind of deserved to be stripped of that power, given how much, you know, how much of a decline the roster had been over the last, you know, 3 to 4 years under his watch. And getting someone with fresh eyes like Dan Quinn made sense at the time. As I said before, I think the main issue, and you seem to be hinting at it, given the take that, you know, it worked out the first couple of years, is I think over time the Falcons got pretty complacent and were pretty confident in the talent that they had added over those first couple of years, that they were going to be all the talent that they really needed. And you can certainly argue that had this team done a better job coaching up that talent, the Vic Beasleys, the Devondre Campbells, Isaiah Oliver, Duke Riley, Wes Schweitzers of the world, they wouldn't have been wrong in that assessment. They just didn't do it. And so we're stuck here where we are, where, you know, those guys didn't quite develop to the degree that I think this coaching staff and this front office wanted them to. Now, I could certainly argue in hindsight that, you know, some of those guys developed as much as they probably should have. Others of those guys did not. I think that's very clear. And so, you know, I remember that being a knock on Mike Smith and people saying, like, oh, and Mike Smith couldn't develop talent. It was like, no, Mike Smith's regime developed the talent. It's just the problem is they didn't have talent. Like, they kept drafting seventh round picks in the third round, and then those guys performed like seventh round picks. And people were like, oh, they didn't develop the talent. It was like, no, they got the most out of Corey Peters and Prince Shimbo and Desmond Southward and Akeem Dent, or, you know, close to it. It's just in Lamar Holmes. They just weren't that very good. They were late round sort of talents that the team just kept drafting, overdrafting. I don't think you can make that same case with Dan Quinn and his regime. I wouldn't say that they overdrafted really that many guys, a couple of guys, certainly, you know, Deidre Sinat, Sean Harlow, you know, maybe some guys in rounds 3 and 4, they probably overdrafted, but for the most part in the first couple of rounds, I don't think they overdrafted guys, and they just, those guys didn't live up to the talent level. But it is what it is. So I hope that answers your question, Frank. I hope that answers all everybody's questions. Again, you can send in future questions for future Q&As that we will probably have next week. I mean, we got, because of the Thursday night game, which, you know, tomorrow's episode will be the crossover Thursday for the Thursday night game. And then Friday's episode, of course, will be the rapid reaction to whatever happens on Thursday night. And because, you know, next week is going to be a little bit open, there's going to be a lot more room for Q&A episodes to sort of fill in the time. I'll see if I can sort of wrangle up a couple of guests to discuss some interesting topics as they come to me. But this is a great opportunity for you guys to send in your feedback on whatever future topics we're going to have, because guess what? You know, after this week, we got one more game and then a bye week. So we really do have the flexibility over the next 2 weeks to really dig deep into the type of topics and conversations that you guys want to have, and whether that includes sending in your questions or sending in your feedback for possible guests and or topics that you want me to discuss on podcasts. You know, you have the floor is basically what I'm getting at. And of course, as a reminder, you can send those in via Twitter at Locked On Falcons, via Facebook at Locked On Falcons, or you can send an email to LockedOnFalcons@mail.com. Appreciate you guys for tuning in. We'll be back tomorrow to preview the Thursday night game. Go vote. Until then.